In the Moment on SDPB is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 20th through 22nd in Brookings.
A landmark Supreme Court decision and its impact on South Dakota policy. From SDPB, today is Thursday, August 1st. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, the process of rulemaking in South Dakota has key differences from what happens on the federal level, and understanding that helps explain the Supreme Court's recent Chevron ruling. Neil Fulton, Dean of the USD Knutson School of Law, joins us to explain. Then a candy-colored art installation at the Washington Pavilion invites you into the inner sanctuary of the found, the collected, the remembered, and the created. We'll talk with the artists about the exhibit ahead of its public opening. Plus, Vermilion Songsters Fine Mess gather around the microphones for some live music. That's coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. In June, the U.S. Supreme Court ended something called the Chevron deference. In general terms, they took away some of the policymaking power of federal agencies, which are overseen by the executive branch or the president, and they gave that influence to federal judges whenever laws, which of course are passed by Congress, are a bit unclear. So what comes out of Washington does have similarities to what comes out of Peer, but the rulemaking process at the federal level has some key differences to what happens in the state. So we're going to unpack all of this a little bit more with Neil Fulton. He is Dean of the Knutson School of Law at the University of South Dakota, and he's joining us from SDPB Studios on the USD campus in Vermilion. Dean Fulton, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Always a pleasure, Laurie. Thank you for inviting me.
We need to make an adjustment to that microphone before we get started. Make sure you're at one that I can hear you at a little bit. Say hello, Dean Fulton.
Hello.
That's so much better. All right. I want people to be able to hear you, so we'll get it right before we kick things off. The South Dakota Law Review has an article that is written by you and some others talking about legislative oversight of the administrative state and looking at how this works in South Dakota, which I think is super useful to understand the Chevron ruling at the federal level. But let's start by defining the administrative state, because these are people. These are Americans who are working at federal agencies. Administrative state sounds a little bit intimidating, yeah? So help us understand who we're talking about here.
Yeah, I mean, my definition might not be everyone's because there is some politicization of what the administrative state is. The definition I would use would be the agencies of the executive branch at state or local government. You know, here in South Dakota, the folks working at the Department of Game, Fish, and Parks, the Department of Health, the Department of Revenue, the folks who are actually implementing the programs that are created by the legislature and the executive branch would be what a lot of folks talk about as the administrative state. I think when people use that term sort of pejoratively, the concern they have is the creeping of bureaucracy, right, and having more power put in large executive agencies, particularly at the federal level, and perhaps a concern about political accountability that exists to a greater degree with the legislature.
All right. So let's start in South Dakota and how this works, because in South Dakota there's also a committee. When lawmakers write laws, they don't just go into effect. There's another step. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So here in South Dakota, we have something called Interim Rules Review. And the article that you're referring to that I put together with Professor Patrick Gary and a student down here really looked at how frequently South Dakota's Interim Rules Review Committee, that is a group of legislators appointed that look at rules and can send those rules back to an earlier step in the promulgation process. When a rule is put forward, there's an opportunity for the public to comment on it, for people to suggest changes, for the agency to make those changes. And interim rules can send the rule back and say, hey, look, you need to go back and take more input, or you need to align this better with the actual underlying statute. We looked at how often interim rules does that. That is something that's unique to South Dakota as compared to Congress. here in South Dakota, interim rules has existed for a longer period and has been used more often. Congress now has a somewhat similar process where Congress can intervene and stop the implementation of a rule, but it doesn't have to affirmatively go through congressional review like we require here in South Dakota.
Would that be impractical? Or was there ever a time that it was closer aligned with our process?
That's a great question as to whether it's practical. There wasn't a time where it was more aligned. The question of whether it's really practical at the congressional level is a great one, and there's some developing scholarship around that, because how it works is if an administrative agency is going to promulgate a rule, they have to give notice to Congress that that rule is going to take effect. Congress then has a window of time in which they can affirmatively assert, oh, hold on, we're going to take a look at this and we may in fact stop it or send it back. The practicability question you raise comes up, does Congress even see these notices? I mean, the volume of rules promulgated about banking, healthcare, other areas at the federal level is really voluminous. Mm-hmm. Members of Congress are very busy doing a lot of stuff, and so are their staff, and so there's a question of whether they even see that and whether there's the time, I think, for the political will to assemble to actually stop. When that process has been used at the federal level, it's mostly been at the transition of executive administrations, right? So you have the transition from the Bush to the Obama White Houses. There are instances where rules were stopped at that point for some pretty obvious reasons and some pretty obvious attention from Congress as there's a change in approach.
So does Congress leave uncertainty sometimes on purpose, as in, well, we know that the because of, and we'll kind of maybe need to explain the Chevron deference a little bit, but, you know, broadly speaking, have they occasionally said, we're going to leave this a little bit vague in our lawmaking because we know the scientists and the experts and the specialists are going to enforce this rule through the intention? I guess, you see what I'm trying to get at? Like, is it Congress's job to create the intention and then the executive branch's federal agencies to figure out how it's implemented, or is everything supposed to be coming from Congress and it's just gotten at the federal level away from that?
That is a great question, and I'm going to invite you back in the spring, Lori, to my legislation class where we spend about a week talking about this exact question, right?
Yeah.
So you have obviously a requirement that the law is passed by Congress and then approved by the executive branch by signature, or Congress overrides a veto, right? So Congress has to make the law. The reality, though, now is in really complex regulatory environments, right? If you're promulgating environmental regulations or banking regulations or healthcare regulations, there's a level of technical detail that, you know, in my opinion, the legislature just can't operate at. So they're going to purposely delegate some rulemaking authority to these executive agencies and say, hey, you need to fill in certain gaps in this statute, which we have created purposefully. Mm-hmm. So some of the dispute then comes about how big those gaps can be that Congress leaves purposefully, and what do you do with some of the gaps that may arise unintentionally? You know, language is imperfect, and so you have ambiguities that creep in because we heard it in the news discussion beforehand, right? The idea of processed food may be a thing that when you take that word, that term, and try and apply it, you get some ambiguity that creeps in. Or it may just be that the legislature said, hey, Department of Revenue, you guys go figure this out. So what Chevron told us was that in an instance where there's an ambiguous term in a statute, the executive agency that was tasked with enforcing that statute could interpret that term, and courts had to give deference to that interpretation. And the Supreme Court recently said, hold on, actually, that, the interpretation of the statute, is a job that's given to courts by the Administrative Procedures Act and the separation of powers. So we're going to take that back from you, executive agencies, and we're going to decide what the law means when there's an ambiguity.
All right. So this started, what, in the Reagan administration? Chevron is like the oil company, right? And so the argument is that regardless of what side of the aisle you are on, this will have a very large impact on you. At that time, the law sort of helped, or the ruling sort of helped what many people consider the polluters, avoid some regulation on, or no, I can't remember. Anyway, it's all very confusing to me.
Yeah.
But the point is that depending on who is in charge, the impact is huge. Help me untangle my brain, because now I'm stuck in trying to figure out what the impact of this will be, because it's not just one political party that's impacting, is what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you're exactly right. And to me, Chevron is really interesting because it is the push and pull of the three coordinate branches of government, right? The legislature makes law, the executive branch effectuates and implements law, and the courts interpret law. That's pretty Schoolhouse Rock description of separation of powers, and that's clear and understandable. The reality, though, is more complex, as it frequently is, right? And so the creation of law and the effectuation of law pushes and pulls against each other, right? Because you may have instances where a legislature says, hey, we don't know the complexity of this, and so we're going to give authority to an agency that really works on a regular basis with these complex ideas. Banking is a great example, right? Regulation of credit cards, that's really complicated and really technical, and there are people who spend a lot of time on that. It's not the 435 members of Congress for the most part, right? It's people in the industry and people regulating that. Mm-hmm. So the really interesting question to me about Chevron and the major questions doctrine and a couple other doctrines that really deal with the division of power is not what happens if you get an ambiguous term, right? Like bay can be ambiguous. I could be referring to a brown horse or a semi-enclosed body of water. Mm-hmm. Where it really becomes significant is what you do when executive agencies are given some authority to define a term. In Chevron, it was what's a stationary source of air pollution. And the Environmental Protection Agency said, well, it's like you put a bubble over the entire plant, right? You've got 10 pipes in this plant emitting pollution. We're going to treat them as one stationary source. Multiple ways you could approach that, but Chevron was about, in those instances where there's like an open-ended question, we're going to let the agencies resolve that. And you're really getting at the really complicated question of how should we allocate that responsibility? And I think what we don't know in the decision that reversed Chevron just yet is how we're going to resolve ambiguous terms, because even the majority opinion says that we're going to leave some room for agencies to fill in gaps. And so I think there's going to be successive cases where we wrestle with, is this an ambiguity or is this a purposeful gap left in the statute where Congress wanted the agency to fill in?
The dissent to this case rings all kinds of alarm bells for the impact this could have in America. Realistically, what do you think the impact? Can you give me an example of what we might see in the future? Because in my mind, I just think of a great slowing down of processes. But what else? What is the reasonable impact of this ruling, and how might it play out in our lives?
So for me, you know, the question that I really wrestle with is, what is the allocation of policymaking authority? The majority would present the Loper-Bright-Raimondo case. That's the case that overruled Chevron, is very much stepping back and properly allocating the lines of authority to the coordinate branches. I think there is a real potential, right, to say in these instances where there's been a purposeful ambiguity or gap that's deferred to an agency to fill in, that the court's assertion of our ability to interpret what the law says can in fact be an instance to make policy choices. There are instances where statutes are ambiguous because, hey, just language is imperfect and you have to know a little bit more to determine whether bay means brown horse or semi-enclosed body of water. There are also ambiguities where the political branches have reached a concord on how we're going to allocate responsibility to resolve some things. And those instances, right, like Chevron itself, where we define what's a stationary source, you have a real potential for the courts themselves to come in and say, we disagree with that. Mm-hmm. And to a degree, it's policymaking presented as legal interpretation. And I think there's some danger in that. I mean, so A thing I would say to watch in this is the framers were brilliant, and they created separation of powers and checks and balances to really keep this positive tension between branches. And overruling Chevron definitely pulls some power back to the courts. That may be good, that may be bad, but we don't know how it's going to play out yet. And that is really the interesting question for me to see going forward is the non-political branch's assertion of authority, and does that really start to trump the political branches in these policy-making settings?
Yeah, interesting. Well, hopefully when we have maybe an example in the real world, you'll come back and help us parse that out a little bit. But for now, thank you so much for spending time helping us understand it.
Appreciate it. It's a nerdy topic. Glad to talk about it, Lori.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, the Visual Arts Center at the Washington Pavilion in Sioux Falls is about to open what I'm calling a monumental artistic achievement. It is big. It is bright. It is colorful. It looks oh so soft. It's called Dear Diary, and it is a new art exhibition there. It takes everyday scenes and reimagines them, reinvents them with fur, fabric, found items, created and crafted items, repurposed items. We have the artists and the lead curator of the Visual Arts Center in our studio. So Jana Anderson, welcome back, lead
thank
curator.
You.
Aaron Murtha and Noelle Vinica are the
yes.
artists. Noelle,
thank you.
Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
All right. This is almost hard to describe, but when you walk into this space, it is floor to ceiling for starters. It is an enormous gallery. So, Jana, talk a little bit. And there's thousands of objects in various configurations. How, when you first heard about this exhibition and installation and what it might be like, what did you think about the scale of it and sort of how you were going to pull off, help the artists pull off their vision, really?
Yeah, well, it's been wonderful to work with these two artists. When they brought the artwork in, it definitely kept coming in. It kept coming in. There were loads and loads of artwork. And as you said, this is a monumental achievement by these two, making artwork for the preparing for the show for the past couple of years, but making artwork for this exhibition and for their bodies of work over many years before that as well. So the challenge of installing an exhibition with that amount of work, they had an incredible vision that we helped bring to life.
Mm-hmm. All right. The tiniest thing to the largest, you know, fabric piece to everything in between. How much of your lives has making the things that have gone into this exhibition, it's childhood.
Yeah,
Aaron,
yeah.
Start with you. Tell us, help us explain the vision and the artist statement behind this broadly so we can get people to use their imaginations, and then we'll go into some detailed elements of the exhibit
sure.
that I want to ask you about.
Yeah, for me, the concept of the show was trying to think of it, laying it out as a map and kind of going through your life in like a almost in what you would do in a daily, day-to-day process, mm-hmm. but at the same time also going back in your memory, if that makes sense. It probably doesn't.
Yeah.
But we start out the map, and you come into this grocery store, and then you walk into like more of this convenience area, sort of this food that you put on a pedestal and think about and want. And then also there's like your trash of everyday life. And then you go outside because you're on your way home. You went to the grocery store. You're on your way home. And you come into your kitchen and your dining room and your living room and your bathroom. And you have a reprise in your bedroom. And
yeah.
that's we took all of that and then extrapolated it on thinking about from your childhood to, I think we both went to mostly high school-ish age.
Yeah, kind of like a teenager.
Yeah. So it's familiar when
yes.
you walk in.
Yes.
It's like all of a sudden you're like, oh, I feel good here. I feel like I am in a, you know, a real world in a mm-hmm. life. But then as you get closer and closer, first of all, as you get closer and closer, the astonishing ability of your artistry, the skill, I'm speechless.
about and the imagination of it. I'm in there with a Washington Pavilion employee, and I don't know if he was just discovering this or if he was like pointing it out to me so that I would discover it, but it was like the outlet of a lamp that, you know, where you have crafted its own outlet and is sitting a few feet away from the actual power outlet. And it's like sewn out of, that's yours, isn't it, Erin?
A big part of a lot of my pieces is I wanted to create little vignettes so that way you could almost immerse yourself in the piece, but you had to kind of put the rest of the pieces together. So we create part of the memory, and then you have to fill in the gaps. And my hope is that when people go to the show, they see these things and they start to feel the stories in their heads and the things that they're starting to remember. And it's just the power of nostalgia, just that huge impact that the
and
fine
Erin,
art can
there's
have.
A part in here where you say, and I think if I messed up the, because, you know, if it's your art instead of yours, please correct me, but let's talk about that in a minute.
Yes, that was definitely a part.
but Erin, like, imagination was not easy for you as a child. You had to, like, learn how to figure out when someone said, you make it up. And you're like, what? Tell us a little bit, because this is the most imaginative art exhibit I think maybe I've ever seen, and yet you have this, you know, artist vision that says, yeah, I wasn't always good at imagining things.
Yeah, I actually have aphantasia, so I am blind in my mind's eye. I can't see pictures in my head, so I didn't understand the concept of imagination. I would play with things and play with toys, but I remember one time I was playing with my brother, and he was like, oh, we're soaring through the air, and I was like, okay, stop. What do you mean? And he's like, well, you just make it up and then you're there. And then I started imagining from there and I realized I could just make anything up and then I could do it.
Yeah. Good so, tip, brother, because she's never stopped. And you mentioned trash and Noella's, yours, the McDonald's bag where you just like created your McDonald's trash out of in a frenzy one night. Tell me a little bit to take people to that micro level. You know, you're walking, there's a case and it's essentially, you know, a McDonald's meal reimagined out of other artistic materials than the paper that you might get from McDonald's. So talk about that and the experience and the process of making it.
Sure. So that specific piece, I called it Ethereal McDonald's, I think. I want to say it was literally after I had like gone through the drive-thru, gotten, for me, a number 7, the 2 cheeseburger meal, that's maybe what I order at McDonald's. And I'm like looking at all this, you know, anytime you eat anything or any, I'm very fascinated by the trash that we create. So I'm like looking at this trash sitting on my tabletop or my seat of my car or whatever. And I'm like, how can I make this more permanent? And so I kind of just look through my, you know, things that I have in my studio that I thrift here and there. And I was, like, really drawn to, in that moment, this, like, clear cellophane. And, like, at one point at Lewis Drugstore, I'd picked up, like, this neon, like, vinyl book cover stuff. So you'll see, like, almost a stickery texture in there. And then I was, like, had some Dollar Tree pastel tissue paper. I think that's one of the main ones. So kind of what I started with was just looking at the papers. So, like, the papers that wrap the hamburgers, and I, like, recreated all the graphics on that. And then kind of from there, I went and, like, cut everything apart and traced it all 1-to-1 ratio. So it's, like, it looks exactly how it should. But it's, like, in all this, kind of, like, baby colors, baby nursery pastel colors, and I just found it very pleasing. It was, like, I think it was, like, my most favorite thing I made that year.
I absolutely love that. I looked at it for a long time, and then I also thought that it was giving all of us, I hope this comes out in the right way, like the permission to be a little obsessively mad.
Yes.
You know, there's something in there like, I'm not sure you were okay when you made that, but that gives me permission to go do the thing.
And absolutely,
like,
yeah.
You know, how you're in the middle of it and you're like, what am I doing? Keep going. Keep doing
it. Yes, exactly. Yep.
Yeah. How do you work on that as artists, because I've not seen anything like this before? I mean, certainly there's, you know, there's artistic reference points, you know, for sure, but to give yourself permission to do the weird and wonderful thing that somebody else might say, why are you doing that?
Yeah. For me, I guess, just as, so I'm a high school art teacher. That's my full-time job. So I'm an art teacher on break right now, which gave me time to do this show, thank goodness.
But I really try to make art like on while my students are working as much as possible, and like it really is invigorating for me to continue my own creative practice and make sure I'm still working through my own ideas, and that helps me stay more motivated, you know, when things get tough in the school, dramatics and things like that. So, but yeah, that's one of the big points for me.
Aaron, permission to follow creative ideas. Is that easy for you, or is that, have you struggled with that over the years?
Oh, it comes pretty naturally. But for me, it was like the big space to fill meant that I could create a full narrative. A lot of times when my art's been in galleries in the past, I can only just put a little snippet, and there's all this backlog in my head and this backlog that I just can't get out. But this show, having the space to expand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a magnum, there's a magnum opus feeling to it where you sit back and you're like, wow.
Yeah. So with that, I mean, a lot of our, when Jana was saying some of this work goes years back, in a way it's kind of a retrospective because I think with both of us, 2017-18, I think, is when a lot of my series and these started. So when we were making the original concept, we were kind of taking those ideas and, like, building this map and going, okay, we can all take these themes and just go crazy with them.
Yeah,
and
I remember. You were like, I don't know if I have anything for that. I was like, oh, look at this series and this series. Noelle, I've been following you. I know this. And she's like, oh, yeah.
Like, I forget. I make so much, I guess, which sounds silly, but that's sometimes amazing. Forget what I
but
have.
That's part of what this show brought up for me, too, is that in a society we make so much that, you know, we're so materialistic. We're so all these things, you know, the Happy Meals and the you know, the children's toys and in the food that we get. But there is also this monumental creation of these two artists that are turning back that over and over on its head, like a lake turning over and over as the seasons progress. I'm fascinated, Aaron, if you would talk about the fiber part of this and, like, how you handle line with a sewing machine.
Oh, sure. Well, basically, I use a regular, I got, like, a $100 sewing machine. I upgraded from my free one from my friend in high school. Just kind of manually move. It's hard to explain on the radio, I think, but I just kind of move my piece around. So it's like a reverse pencil. If you think of the needle as the paper and your hands kind of as the pencil, that's how it works.
Ah, so there's a freeness to your line. Noelle, how would you describe how she uses line in when she's using a sewing machine? Because there's limitations to that.
Yes.
Versus if you had, you know, 10 different pencils in front of you or...
Well, you're kind of limited to the machination, however you say that, of the needle. Well, because you take off the foot to do freeze, and then you can kind of scooch it around.
Yeah, it's astonishing.
Yeah,
what you're able to create with that.
Yeah,
there is a corner of the exhibit, and if you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. We're talking about this art exhibition at the Washington Pavilion in Sioux Falls, which opens really tonight with a public event, but it's called Dear Diary. And Aaron, there's a bedroom. You know, there's a tribute to the sort of the tenderness of a child's bedroom, particularly a girl's bedroom, and the expression of girlness that this one child is doing. Take us into that corner and tell me a little bit about the importance of a room of your own.
Gosh, having a space of your own to really expand and explode in your own imagination was huge. I think I mentioned in the show, too, that I shared a bedroom for a short period of time. So once I had my own bedroom and was able to just make it as messy or as clean as I wanted, I would often just, you know, you'd spend time like getting as messy as possible, and then you would organize it all, and then I would document the organization. Even as a kid, I would take pictures. I'd borrow my mom's camera to take pictures. And so that childhood bedroom for me is just a reflection of all the things and objects in my life that were really important to me.
Yeah. So. Did you take pictures when it was messy, too?
No, just clean.
When it was clean. That was the moment that you were documenting.
Yeah, messy. I don't think you could tell on details.
Yeah. And Noelle, so much about information. Oh,
in
yes,
your work showing
totally.
Up of the, yep. this, the onslaught of information
yes.
and how it merges and tangles in your brain. Talk about that, please.
Okay. So yeah, this kind of translates from front to back of the whole gallery, like in different ways through each of the different areas. So I'm really interested in like marketing and advertising and how we are so influenced to like buy things. One of the lessons I teach with my photography class, I teach a digital photography class at the high school in Watertown is where I teach. Anyway, so I have an advertising project with them and I kind of get on my soapbox a little bit talking about just this idea of everything we buy, we expect to be like the next thing that's gonna make our life instantly better. But we know that that's not true. Like mm-hmm. we know that, but we also want to believe it. So there's this translation of, you know, I'm reading this ad, I'm looking at this newspaper, I'm walking through this grocery store or this store, and like all these things are kind of visually assaulting me and like wanting my attention. And all of this overabundance of information just kind of becomes nonsensical to me in a way. And I like to put that together in a way that either within the series itself or like, so this is one that you're going to have to come back for, like by my mailbox, there's part of it out, but I like to even look at like editorial, different like illustrations and headlines, and like chopping up different pieces and like building collages and then, making drawings out of them. But, even like all the way back to, you know, in the outdoor section, drawing like hardware store ads and like that just reminds me of like my dad and, you mm-hmm. know, things that all the things that you need in your life. I'm just like constantly wondering how people pay for all the things that we need, but like, we need them, but like the things that we want. And how do you decide which one to buy? Well, you read the reviews and then you're still not really sold on something, but you still got to buy something. So what do you buy? Like, it's just sometimes just that visual and mental like overwhelm of all the things that we have to somehow process. And then you buy it and then it eventually disintegrates or it was terrible. So then you have to buy another one. You know, we all know this. So,
Jana, the idea of, okay, you can't touch the art, mm-hmm. right? And there's a big old sign because you're going to want to touch the art. You're going to want to throw yourself onto parts of this exhibit. You cannot do it. There's a little, you know, a little table. There's a little touch table there.
Yes.
It's good. It's not going to satisfy your desire to lift things up and hold them in their hands. However, once I gave into that, I was standing, I think, by the bathroom where the bathtub was, and you know, there's fabric that's, you know, describing the water or evoking the water, because I could not step into the shower, which is what, of course, you want to do. Because I couldn't do that, my mind had to imagine, and then all of a sudden, I was telling my own stories about shower curtains and, you know, restaurants and places that it reminded me of. So what do you hope the audience, the gallery goer experience will be of this, Dear Diary?
Yeah, this is a truly immersive installation experience. And sort of like what Erin Murtha said a little bit ago, of you have to put your own imagination and memories to some of these pieces. So yes, there is a couple of areas where you can touch the fabric and see what this feels like, but you can do that sort of haptic memory within yourself as you're experiencing it. So bringing these two artists together, there is such an expansive quality to Noelle's work and maybe a more quiet detail to Erin's work that you really get to expose yourself visually while you're walking through.
Yeah. All right. So the artist reception is tomorrow night.
Yes. Tomorrow night from 5 to 8.
It's first Friday.
Free first Friday at the Washington Pavilion Visual Arts Center. It'll be a great time.
Open until December.
Yes.
So, Noelle, Erin, Jana, thank you so much for being here.
It's just
a delightful thing.
Thank
Go
you.
Back again and again.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Formed in 2020, the indie rock trio Fine Mess has hit the ground performing. Earlier this week, they released a new album, and this Friday they take to the Levitt stage. The group includes Joe Raisch on guitar and vocals, Amy Askew on bass and vocals, and Jeff
Wessner on drums and vocals, and Joe Raich and Jeff are with us now from SCPB Studios in Vermilion. Joe, welcome back.
Thanks for having us again.
Jeff, thanks for being here.
Yeah, appreciate it.
I didn't get to talk to you last time. Jackie Hendry got to talk to you last
time.
Right. So I'm very excited because we were fighting over that one. but she's a big fan of so many of your different bands that you've been in over the years. And so that was really fun. And tell us a little bit, Joe, let's start with you, about the new album or the most recent album and the kind of music that you've been making together lately.
Yeah, we recorded this July, I believe, of last year down in Omaha. And it's a little different from some of the earlier stuff. I think just the longer that the three of us play together, the more it kind of it gels. Like I kind of know what Jeff brings. I know what Amy will bring. We work really well together. So this, I think, is... I mean, it might sound pompous, but I think musically it's some of the most interesting that we've done.
Turns out we're really proud of it.
We're very proud of this one. Everything is just a small evolution. Some of it is quiet folk-ish. Some of it is a little more upbeat rocker, indie rock with the more grungy sound. So it's everything, which... It's kind of what we've been doing the whole time we've been together, but it's just those small evolutionary steps.
So we kind of were getting at this with two visual artists a few minutes ago, and just having this exhibition together and bringing their music in or bringing their art in and out, and you know, when does one end and the other begins? And in a band, that's very, you know, you're dealing with that every day. You're all bringing your full selves to the music. When do you, Jeff, think that, like, oh, this is us? You know, this is, here's three individuals, but now it's a band.
Yeah, I mean, I think that comes with, like, in part with songwriting a bit. Joe writes most of the songs, but they don't, you know, he doesn't tell us what to play. And so in some groups, you kind of play what somebody else wants you to play. But in this group, he trusts us to come up with our own parts, right? And so then we add in something, and the song will change in that way, in which it, we might hear a demo recording and then we hear the full recording later, maybe a year or two later, and it sounds very different, but we like it better. And so it feels like, well, yeah, that music, you know, is there. The songs are already there. They're great songs. But then we can, you know, it takes other musicians. You know, it's just kind of things change when you collaborate in that way. So that's why it feels very much like a band. It's not really a one person leading the thing and gathering musicians. It's definitely a, you know, it's definitely a collaboration.
Yeah. Joe, what is that process like for you when you might send something out and then wait for the response?
Yeah, it can be nerve-wracking just because I'll write something or I'll get like just the germ of an idea or whatever.
And we
I'll
say, nope.
Yep. Nope. They'll be like, move on. What's next? It's I'll record something. I'll love it. And I'll be like, okay. And then you show other people and it's you hope that they like it. And there's been enough songs where the first time I play it, we forget about it for months, and then I'll bring it back up and we'll work it up and it'll change a little bit. And Jeff has straight up said at a practice, or Amy too, where it was like, you know, when you first brought this, I was kind of like, no, like this is a miss. I don't like this song. But then the evolution of it, letting kind of them find their own part of that song and letting it evolve. And sometimes I listen back to the demo that I recorded on my phone 2 years earlier and I think, oh, this part is missing, but I also recognize that what it has become is a better song and it's more of a collective, and that's what's important, right? About when you're working with other people.
I love how you articulated that. All right, let's hear some music. You guys all set up there and ready to play something? Set it up for us.
Absolutely. This first one that we're going to play is called Cold Chicken and Scotch. Some of our titles don't make any sense as far as what the song goes with. But this one, I guess, when I'm thinking of cold chicken and scotch, I'm thinking of just kind of sadness. But because if you're eating cold chicken and eating scotch, things probably haven't gone great that day.
There's a story.
Especially eating the scotch.
There's a story behind that day.
Yes, but this is off the new album that just came out a few days ago. The vinyl is still being printed and will come out in, I think, like a month and a half. But Cold Chicken and Scotch.
I'll be your weekend, I'll be your retreat, I'll be the thing that you're looking forward to. I can be that for you. I'll be your secret, I'll be your regret, I'll be the voice on the line at a quarter past two, just to listen to you. Somebody said, I'm the last chance you should take, but I can't figure out, how can I be any worse than the ache? I'll be your scapegoat, I'll be your alibi, I'll be the lie that you tell when you don't want the truth. I can be that for you. Somebody said, I'm the last chance you should take, but I can't figure out, how can I be any worse than the ache?
Tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. That is Fine Mess. Joe and Jeff are in the studios in Vermilion. Amy will be joining them for the full band performing at the Levitt. Music kicks off at 7 this Friday. And before I forget, you know, they sound great because they're great, but also SDPB engineer Brian Adams,
yes,
nicely
yes.
done.
Because Brian Adams.
Because he has set that up with a beautiful mix, so that sounds
nice.
Great in our ears.
Thank you, Brian.
Yeah, thank you, Brian. Let's do one more. Why don't you go right into the other one while you, while you're close to the mics and ready to roll.
Okay. This one's called Hinges. This is also off of the album that just came out. Yeah, I don't really have anything else to say about this one.
The music says it all.
There we go. Take how much you can take.
the hang a poster on the wall, till you point to where you fall, 'cause we all fall. Take the hinges, not the door, not the door. And I've seen your fingers uncurl as you let go of this world, of this world. But you hold on. Break. See how much of this you can take, how much you can take. The hang a poster on the wall, till you point to where you fall, 'cause we all fall. But you hold on.
Is Fine Mess live from our SDPB studios in Vermilion, and that is our show for today. You can hear them with Amy all at the Levitt this Friday. Special thanks to SDPB's Brian Adams for setting that up. Joe and Jeff, awesome. And look at that timing, hitting the hard break at the end of the show, too.
Nice.
masters of live radio.
There we go. You'll have us back, maybe.
We will. See you guys next time.
Thank you.
Thanks.
From all of us at SDPB, we thank you for listening.